In Last Word this week, Francis Wheen, Jeremy Hardy, Melvin Bragg and Christopher Matthew pay tribute to Alan Corran. Also, Deborah Carr, beautiful Hollywood star of From Here to Eternity and The King and I, who could have ended up in a very different job.
I was on one of my reports from my boarding school in Bristol, I think, when the headmistress suggested to my parents that with my particular talents I would be extremely advantageous to the civil service. I think she must have been off her head.
And the Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, on his theology tutor at Cambridge, and the man who officiated at his wedding, the Reverend Professor C.F.D. Mole. First, for more than 30 years, he was at the heart of the news quiz.
Alan, which new mode of transport's arrival was greeted with a less than electric reception?
Yeah. about 15, maybe 20 years ago, you told me you got it in front of you when I was a lot slimmer. I road tested one of these. It's the world's smallest car. They sent it round. It was like a motorised condom. I just put it on. It's called a Sinclair C5. It's the worst car ever built. And it was, well, they won't know this on radio, but it was that high, you'll have to guess. And it was a swine to drive because pedestrians trod on you. And, and whenever you stopped, which was very frequently, it didn't have a roof, so you were susceptible to dog whittle.
Alan Corran, of course, who's died aged 69. The writer and broadcaster was also a former editor of Punch magazine, a team captain on Call My Bluff, and the author of many books. Since 1988, he'd written a popular column for the Times newspaper. The editor of the Times, Robert Thompson, said Corran had been a witty and thoughtful tour guide through life. Alan Corran made his first appearance on the News Quiz in 1975. Over time, he was joined by fellow panellists Jeremy Hardy and Francis Wheen. I asked Francis whether Alan thought the programme had got better or worse with age.
I think he thought it got better. He liked to play the grumpy old man, and in the early days of the News Quiz, it was almost all journalists, and then over the last 15 years or so, it was much more comedians and stand-up comics and things, and he liked to grumble about that a bit and cling to me as the fellow journalist, because he always thought of himself as a journalist rather than a comedian, even though he was very, very funny. And he'd say, oh, we better stick together because these comedians are going to do us out of a job because they're much funnier than us. We don't stand a chance. But actually, I think he felt it had improved no end, although he would grumble about it. It was sort of self-mocking grumpiness. And people like Jeremy and Linda Smith, when they came along, he was actually delighted.
Jeremy, did you find him very welcoming?
Yes, I was warned early on, never interrupt Alan because he gets grumpy if interrupted, but that was because he always had a sort of flight of fancy that would go somewhere and you had to sort of stand back and give him the time. And so but it was always a delight to do that, to just let him spin his sort of yarn, which he hadn't prepared, but would always end up with a brilliant punchline. He loved the banter. He didn't like when people turned up with an act to do, but he liked when it was all very chatty, and especially when Linda was alive and people like Francis and Andy Hamilton and myself would just be knocking the subjects around. I think he was always a closet comedian. He had a very good timing, and he had a sort of rather rambunctious music hall style, really. And he was very good at telling jokes, particularly Jewish jokes.
He was quite funny. He was very dapper. He was always very neatly turned out, and he was rather brisk in his manner. You know, when he arrived, he'd sort of stride into a room. There's no sort of slouching in. And he was like that on stage. You know, he'd sort of get on stage and want to get on with it. He was very businesslike and lively and energetic in that sense. He partly wanted to get on with it so he could go home and have dinner with his wife. But I think also he wanted to get on with it because he just enjoyed performing.
He was a very strong man and very sort of solid. And I always called him Dad on the show. And I think we are very lost without him. We used to quite enjoy the shows when he wasn't there because we could muck about more. And the recording would go on for a very long time. He used to get very irritated if we recorded for too long because he always wanted to get home to his wife.
Well, that's one of the most touching things about him because he, after the recordings, usually most of us go off to the pub. Whereas Alan would always immediately rush off the stage and race home to go and have dinner with his wife. I mean, they were married for well over 40 years. They were utterly devoted, and he was also very devoted to his children.
Where do you think he found the inspiration for his humour? What were his favourite targets?
Goodness, well, it was very odd because actually he moved in quite grand circles in a way. He'd been editor of Punch for years, and they used to have these famous Punch lunches where you know, people like Prince Philip would turn up, let alone Geoffrey Archer, and goodness knows who. And he would occasionally let slip, you know, that he'd been in Geoffrey Archer's box at Lord's the previous day, or had been round at Buckingham Palace for lunch with Prince Philip or something. But it didn't seem to inhibit him terrifically. I mean, he was still quite happy to weigh into them, and he was sort of untainted by all that. And he was, you know, he was basically sitting at home, well, in Cricklewood for years and years, and then more recently near Regent's Park, and maintained this pose of the person who was utterly detached from the world, even though he was, as I say, remarkably well-connected. I think the inspiration for his humour, as Jeremy said, was also, he wasn't a devout or practising Jew, but he was very conscious of his Jewishness, and he was a great connoisseur of Jewish humour. I mean, he had a vast repertoire of old Jewish jokes and things. And actually, it obviously meant quite a lot to him, because there was a strange business. Whenever we went to do an outside broadcast, you know, from Durham or somewhere, he would always insist on going by car. He wouldn't come on the train with the rest of us. And I remember a few years ago, eventually Simon Hoggart persuaded him to go by train on the way back from Bournemouth or somewhere. And Alan got on rather grumpily and then sat there absolutely sort of rigid with terror for the whole journey. And Simon said, "What on earth is the matter?" And Alan said, "I can't get on a train without thinking it's the train to Auschwitz." And it obviously, you know, it obviously was quite a powerful influence on his life, his Jewish upbringing, and indeed the Second World War. I mean, he was sort of famous for carrying on World War II against the Germans 50 years after the end of it.
Jeremy, was he funny off stage, as it were? Was he somebody who, when you went to the pub with him or when you had time with him, entertained you with stories, or did he save his performance for the microphone?
Yeah, well, as Francis said, I mean, he wouldn't come to the pub. He was a family man. He'd have a meal. Occasionally, once a series, would have a meal, and then he would unwind, and with a couple of glasses of wine in him, he would, no, he was a very engaging and very friendly man, a very warm man, but also quite sort of private, and wasn't pleased about the fact that he was dying, and he had some very severe words to say about God, because he'd just got over this terrible illness last year when we expected to lose him, and he'd fought his way all the way through that, only to fall again to cancer.
Jeremy Hardy and Francis Wheen. Well, Alan Coren was born in 1938, the son of a builder. He was educated at Wadham College, Oxford, and Yale University. I asked his contemporary at Oxford, Melvin, now Lord Bragg, whether he remembered their first meeting.
I do, vividly. I didn't know him, I knew of him. He was a brilliant young man. He got a first, he got a Hartnell scholarship to America. I think he'd already started writing for national magazines and national newspapers, had a short story published. And I was walking through the back court of this college, and he bounced up, stopped to say hello, and we chatted away. And I felt rather blessed that this eminent, distinguished person had been so friendly and continued to be so friendly.
Was it clear from the start that he was going to be a successful humorist?
Oh, yes. He was a brilliant man. He was very fast, very clever. He loved great humorous writers. He started off by writing stuff that was amusing and then wrote some of the stuff that made me laugh out loud in the way that very few people can off the page make you laugh out loud, but Alan could do that. He was scintillatingly witty, and his wit nearly always made you laugh, but sometimes it was his take on politics, as you saw in the news quiz and so on, his take on current affairs. He would always come in on his own, skid in, sell him in from his own side and give it a spin. The spin of wit is what I mean. Yes, he was a great wit. When you were with Alan, you were going to have a good time. That was that, and you did have a good time. And when you read his books, and when you read his columns, and when you worked for him, as I did for several years when he was editing Punch, you were always going to have a good time, which doesn't mean that he was a pushover. He wasn't a pushover as an editor. He wasn't a pushover in arguments. But he was always with the humour there. That's what I want to emphasise, the humour in his life and about his life, and the warmth towards the people he liked, or the politeness towards people he'd just met. There was that; those two strata were there all the time.
What was it like discussing your copy with Alan Coren as editor?
Well, it tended to be one thing or the other. If he liked it, it was terrific. If he didn't like it, you got a flea in your ear. And sometimes you had to reorganise it, which is a mild way of putting it, and that was fine.
Talking to Francis Wheen, he said that Alan Coren had this sort of interesting bunch of friends, many of whom were in the establishment, but that never inhibited him from poking fun at them.
No, like a lot of people who came from what we used to call working-class backgrounds, he was very aware of and loyal to his background, as indeed he was to his Jewish background. But he bumped into people at Oxford and afterwards who'd had much more privileged backgrounds, and he got on with them as well as he got on with the people he'd been at school with. I don't think he saw much difference. I think he took, you know, a man's a man for all that, and that was he just got on with it.
Melvin Bragg. Well, Christopher Matthew wrote for Punch when Alan Corran was editor. The pair went on to celebrate reaching the milestone of retirement age in the Radio 4 series Freedom Pass.
When I went to work for him, I realised that this was a man who did two things as an editor which were completely brilliant. One, he chose who he wanted, and once he'd chosen who he wanted, he simply let you get on with it. There was no kind of trying to direct you all the time. And the other thing about him was that the standard of Punch, particularly at the time that he was there, was so high because he led. I mean, he wrote the first piece, and it was always of a standard that everybody else would like to have achieved. Now, if you do that, it becomes like, you know, he was the Johnny Wilkinson, although perhaps more Phil Vickery, remembering his slightly sort of bulky size. He was, funnily enough, he was quite a sort of solid figure. And I remember, you know, he was quite a substantial figure, although not very tall. And he was sort of man who, you know, you talk about people lighting up rooms when they come in, and he did. And at the beginning, I was always slightly daunted by him.
Where do you think his humour came from?
Oh, gosh. I don't know, really. He wanted to be a don. He wanted to be an academic. And he went to America after getting a first at Oxford.
I thought I'd write and I'd have this sinecure, rather like, I don't know, Malcolm Bradbury or John Wayne. Not that John Wayne. Put the wagons in a circle, we're going to discuss whether Crabb was the last of the Augustans or the first of the Romantics.
He was a brain box. I mean, he got a, you know, he was the first in his family ever to go to Oxford. He worked hard, he got his first, and he went off to America and did this this scholarship. And I think he planned to be an academic and then started writing stuff for Punch while he was there. And then Bernard Hollywood, who was the editor, said, if you want to, you know, if you want a job, come back and join us, which he did.
Was he a part of the establishment or was he outside of the establishment, would you say?
It's very interesting. There was a sort of rivalry with Private Eye, which I was involved with briefly in the very early days as its circulation manager. But anyway, that's another story. But it's funny that Private Eye, in the early 60s, which was supposed to be anti-establishment, was in fact full of gents who were of the establishment. If you went to Punch, they were of the establishment, but the people who worked there weren't. So that's the answer. No, he wasn't, really.
And where did this idea for your programme, Freedom Pass, come from?
Freedom Pass, well, you're far too young, but if you watch occasionally, when you've got on a bus or a tube, you'll see old doddering characters getting out this little orange folder and holding it against, with shaking hands against the thing on the, where you go in, on the where the gates are. No, we knew we had our Freedom Pass, and we talked about it a bit, and we said, aren't these brilliant, because you can go on two or three buses. You don't, you know, you don't have to just do one journey, and then if you want to do another one, it's another, you know, £2. You can go wherever you want. And he said one day, it's ridiculous, you know, we could get on a bus and go to places that either we knew or we wanted to go back to or we'd never been to or had a silly name like Cockfosters, and we could go and see what it's actually like. We often wonder what it's like. So we put in this proposal, which was ludicrous. We never thought for a moment that, you know, our suggestion would get anywhere, and blow me down. There we were, on a bus. I said, where are we going to go? He said, let's go to the zoo. So we set off from his house.
My grandfather, Dave was in the ARP, and on his tin hat he had Dig Ear for Dave, so that if he was ever buried by falling rubble, they'd know where to look. And one night, there was a veranda on this little suburban semi. I live with my grandparents, but my father was off in the war. And God knows what my mother was doing. I don't like to ask. There was an American army base nearby. And the veranda got it. They hadn't bombed the veranda. They bombed the Ferry Aviation Works at Hayes, which was about 2 miles away, and they knocked out the veranda. And my grandfather said, the bastards have got the veranda. As if up there, a Dornier pilot was just taking out a transfer of a greenhouse and slapping it on the side. We have another greenhouse. No more tomatoes for Tommy. It's great. I miss him. Do you know, it's an awful thing to say, and I shouldn't say it on the radio. I miss my grandparents more than I miss my parents. I suppose because as a little kid I spent more time with my grandparents, and they weren't always telling me to do that. I was grateful I was there. My parents were always saying, don't do that, pull your socks up, don't eat this, eat your fat, the boy next door eats all his fat up, there's a war on.
Great fun.
He'll leave a huge gap in national life, won't he?
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking about this morning. I mean, he was a very close friend of mine, and I'll never have another friend like him. it's as though, you know, a huge light has gone out in my life, and it'll have gone out in the lives of all the people who, you know, his family, people who work with him, his friends. But I was reflecting on this morning and thinking that a huge, very bright light has gone out in the lives of all the people who listened to him and the people who read him. And there were thousands upon thousands who loved him, like we all did.
Christopher Matthew on Alan Corran. There'll be a special news quiz tribute to Alan on Radio 4 next Friday evening at 6:30. Now, the film star Deborah Carr was born in Helensburgh, overlooking the Firth of Clyde in Scotland. But that didn't stop Hollywood publicists from selling her as an English rose. Carr specialised in playing beautiful women who, whilst on the surface appearing rather prim and proper, were suffering inner turmoil. Her two most famous roles were as the straight-laced governess clashing with Yul Brynner's monarch in The King and I, and as the adulterous army wife romping in the surf with Burt Lancaster in From Here to Eternity. Deborah Carr originally trained as a ballet dancer, winning a scholarship to Sadler's Wells. But she quickly became fed up with always being in the back row of the swans.
I was never going to achieve the heights, nor the discipline, nor had I started training early enough to be a prima ballerina. I returned home and then decided wanted to be an actress. I was always better at the acting bits of ballet anyway.
Carr started her acting career with walk-on roles at the open-air theatre in Regent's Park. She was spotted by an agent who introduced her to the British film director Michael Powell. They worked together on a number of films, including one of the defining roles of her career in Black Narcissus. Hollywood, in the shape of MGM Studios, came calling. The film historian Sir Christopher Frayling interviewed Deborah Carr for a documentary about her life.
When she arrived in Hollywood, famously, there was a Time magazine cover which had her face on it. They kept saying Botticelli hair and Deborah Carr, it rhymes with star and all that, in case they called her Kerr. And her face was superimposed on a bunch of English roses. It was as if they were dealing with a member of European royalty.
I had to have the young general. I couldn't turn out the holy man. I couldn't stop the wind from blowing and the air from being as clear as crystal, and I couldn't hide the mountain.
I told you it was no place to put a nunnery. Something in the atmosphere that makes everything seem exaggerated.
She was very well known for having played a nun in Black Narcissus, again one of these parts which had inner turmoil.
Yes, one of two nuns. Three governesses, two nuns. Black Narcissus, 1947. So it's a steamy drama about a convent in the Himalayas and all these submerged passions. And she's the sister superior, has to keep the lid on this. So she's the Hitchcock heroine par excellence that never appeared in a Hitchcock film.
Another up-and-coming star appearing with Carr in Black Narcissus was Gene Simmons.
We had a little rather difficult time working together because we're both gigglers. And the more serious the scene got, the worse we behaved. She was more experienced than I was, but I think in that film she gave one of her finest performances. One was always taken aback by her breathtaking beauty. I mean, she's up there with the great beauties of our time.
It's interesting that she herself said that she'd come to Hollywood to act, and then she discovered that all she had to do was wear white gloves and look decorative. Do you think that she was, her beauty in some way overshadowed her acting talent?
I think she was being, had a sense of humour about herself, because she gave some wonderful performances here.
And Sir Christopher Frayling says one of the most notable was in From Here to Eternity.
That was the first film where she really, I think, started playing full-blooded roles in Hollywood.
I was tremendously lucky to get that part, because it did, what's known, didn't break, it shattered the mould.
She dyed her hair blonde, she lost her English accent, and famously she rolled on the Hawaiian sand with Burt Lancaster in his bathing trunks with the crashing waves. It's a wonderful classic love scene. In fact, the American Film Institute has categorised it one of the great love scenes of movie history, which I think it is.
I never knew it could be like this. Nobody ever kissed me the way you do.
Nobody?
No, nobody.
When you met her and sat down to talk to her, was she as straight-laced and uptight as some of these roles would suggest?
On the face of it, very controlled, very dignified, very poised. Remember, she was trained as a dancer, and very poised sort of character. But a really sly sense of humour and a twinkle in her eye. And, you know, the eyes would widen sometimes. She'd get really passionate. She talked about a film she made called The Sundowners, where she plays a long-suffering sheep drover's wife. She said, I should have won the Oscar that year. I really should. And suddenly there was a sort of passion there. And, you know, I asked her what we should call the program. And then she said, call it Not Just an English Rose.
And she was quite sexy, wasn't she? I mean, she had an affair with Michael Powell, and then Stuart Granger wrote in his autobiography that she seduced him in the back of a taxi.
Yes, that's right. And in fact, in the interview, she said, how very gallant of him to mention it, you know. I think that wasn't really playing cricket.
Of course, she was nominated for an Oscar 6 times, but never won until they gave her the honorary Oscar in 1994. It sounds from what you say that she may have resented that slightly.
I think she did slightly. I mean, obviously, in a very controlled way. She should have won one for From Here to Eternity. She should certainly have won one for The Innocents. And I think if there's any justice in the world, she should have won 3 Oscars out of those 6.
What about the part that I suppose many people will associate with her, another governess in The King and I?
Yes, it's Singing Governess, and it's one of the great dubbing triumphs, the way that the singer Marnie Nixon, who did a lot of Hollywood stars at that time, she did Audrey Hepburn in My Fair Lady, segues into Deborah Carr's voice. So Deborah Carr introduces the songs, and they segue into Marnie Nixon's voice. It's an absolute triumph of technology, and you believe that she's singing every single word.
Getting to know you. Getting to know you. Getting to know all about you. Getting to like you. Getting to hope you like me.
We stood side by side and walked through all the songs endlessly and singing them both together. So we would take each other's particular energies so that it would sound just right, and I could get her accent, and then she could, you know, wrap that around her tongue. It was quite a partnership. As a matter of fact, she always gave me credit more than anybody else has if I've done a dubbing. Getting to know
what. She effectively retired from Hollywood. She did a handful of made-for-TV films, but she retired while she was ahead, in a way. She didn't have a long tail of small parts and cameo roles in poor movies, did she?
No, that's right. I think possibly the turning point was when she appeared in the very first misbegotten version of Casino Royale, where she plays a Bond girl at the age of 46. And it's a dreadful film, and she must have realised the writing was on the wall. They just weren't doing roles that were dignified enough for an actress, you know, of her distinction.
Sir Christopher Frayling remembering Deborah Carr, who's died aged 86. Now, for more than 20 years, the Reverend Professor C.F.D. Mole held the oldest chair at Cambridge University. He was Lady Margaret Professor of Divinity, a chair which had been founded in 1502 and held at one time by Erasmus. The theologian, who was known to his friends as Charlie, was a distinguished biblical scholar who published a number of influential books, including The Birth of the New Testament in 1962 and The Origins of Christology in 1977. He was Dean of Clare College for 6 years and a Fellow of the College for more than 60. One of his students was the Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams. They remained friends, and Professor Mole officiated at Rowan Williams' wedding. The Archbishop has fond memories of his teacher.
Charlie Mole's lectures were probably about the best attended in the theology department. He could fill the largest lecture hall in the department at 9 on a Saturday morning, week after week. A very small, rather bird-like man, wire-rimmed glasses and a perky manner. And he always began his lectures with prayer, which I think would be very unusual now in theology departments, but it seemed entirely of a piece with the way he approached his work as an interpreter of the New Testament. You just saw a huge, huge technical competence in Greek, in ancient history, and all the rest of it poured into the service of understanding the New Testament as a text that believers used. And I think that made a huge impression on a lot of people, believers and non-believers.
And he approached all of this from his own unshakable faith. Did that interfere with his independence as a scholastic mind?
It never seemed to interfere at all with proper academic rigour, with a very sort of sober and, in the best sense, dispassionate engagement with the text. I think the only thing it did interfere with was his attitude to other scholars, because I think he felt so embarrassed at making any criticisms. He was a man of such immense charity. And I can remember once he was lecturing to us on the pastoral epistles, the letters to Timothy and Titus in the New Testament, and describing a new book that he just read. And I can still hear him saying, well, it's a very ingenious book, and it's an immensely learned book, and I hugely admire the author, and it's completely wrong. That was very much his style. He hated to disagree. He hated to criticize. And yet, scholarly honesty forced him, really, to saying something about that.
Was he an approachable man? Was he somebody who you dropped by his room for a word of advice?
I think of all the professors in his day, he put himself out to be approachable. Every Tuesday evening, he'd be at home in his rooms in Clare College. And over the academic year, a little group would gather quite regularly on those Tuesday evenings. And I think an awful lot of people, so to speak, cut their teeth on that experience.
What would you say were his most important contributions to our understanding, particularly of the New Testament, which was his specialist area?
Two big achievements, I think. One was simply the technical work he did on the vocabulary of the Greek Testament. But one little book he wrote in the 1970s, The Origins of Christology, came out at a very neuralgic moment in British theology. The Myth of God Incarnate had just been published. A lot of radical thinking about the New Testament was swirling around. And then came this extraordinarily well-researched, well-resourced, but very brief book, simply casting a light of a bit of common sense on some of these issues.
And as a friend, as somebody away from work, was he a good companion?
He was a very good companion. He was quite shy, but not cripplingly so, and not in any way that suggested an arrogance. He was, I think everyone who knew him would have said he was simply one of the most lovable people they'd encountered. But thinking of him with his colleagues, Charlie was, as I say, a small and slight man, and not all his colleagues were, and someone described the sight of him from behind, walking down the street alongside, I think it must have been Professor Donald MacKinnon, as looking a little bit like Shepherd's drawing of Pooh and Piglet.
Did he live a very ascetic life? Was he somebody who eschewed the pleasures of the flesh for the pleasures of the mind?
I wouldn't have described him as ascetic, in the sense of someone who was manifestly self-denying about everything. The truth is rather simpler, that he lived simply. I don't think he was a person who thought much about it, and I think in that sense illustrated very clearly the kind of detachment that's proper to someone of faith. If something is given to you, you say thank you and enjoy it. If it's not given to you, you don't waste any time regretting it. And that was his asceticism, if you like.
The Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, talking about the priest and theologian Professor Charlie Mole, who's died aged 98. This week you also heard last words on the film star Deborah Carr. But we leave you with Alan Coren reacting to being voted greatest living wit by listeners to Radio 4's Word of Mouth programme.
I'm horrified.
Why are you...
Well, I'm delighted and flattered, I have to say that, otherwise everyone will switch off. Well, I'm horrified because the idea of being the best at anything is bad enough. Being the wittiest at anything, it's like being a fast gun. Even now, there'll be young wits out there who will come into pubs and say, I reckon you find yourself pretty handy with a word, you know, that kind of thing, and will outdo it. It's bad enough being thought of, just from the trade one practices, as being someone who is funny away from a typewriter or away from a microphone. It's the going out for dinner where people say, you're a bit quiet tonight, or is anything wrong? Or they say to your wife, is there something you ought to tell us about him? Because they expect you to be on song all the time.
No rest for the witty.
No rest at all.